Aging and the problems of aging. My intention is that it will, after some remarks here, be a discussion. I hope that it will be helpful to you from the standpoint of yourself and perhaps your aging friends. In the matter of how one handles himself, and also how one counsels relative to homes for the aged and all. I have had some experience in this since my father, and before he died, was in one. My mother and my mother-in-law are now in nursing homes, and this is an important area. Whether this should be the way that this is handled. I am interested in aging because I've been doing it quite a while. I've been 39 now for quite a few years. And also my research is in partially in this area. We are doing studies on the lifespan of animals. We have a rather large beagle colony, if you call 1,100 beagles a large colony. And these are lifespan studies, and part of this is an aging study, what to define what is happening in these. We are also interested in proposing some things that may modify this. I'll have some more remarks to say about this probably near the end. I would like to give you two readings before we begin. I often, in introducing many of my lectures, read from George MacDonald. George MacDonald was a very great Scotch cleric in the 1800s. His writings were probably responsible for the conversion of C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis did an anthology of George MacDonald, a book which I carry and have carried with me, I guess, most of the time since Al Rognes gave it to me in 1962. Now, I often read from his Diary of an Old Soul, which is sort of a poem for every day, but unfortunately, in my haste in packing up for this, for coming here, I left it and I couldn't find it in the library here. But I will read from his anthology, because this applies, I think, to your regard for those of us who are aging. It is by loving and not by being loved that one can come nearest to the soul of another. And then some words from Browning. Grow old along with me, the best is yet to be. The last of life for which the first was made. And these are probably, hopefully, encouraging words, because as one examines aging, and ever since man has become aware of this and realized that it was happening to him, since then he has attempted to either avoid it, reverse it, or, as I am trying to do, understand it. Now, many, of course, try to avoid it. I often tell this story about it was some kind of a get together, and this gentleman was there, and he spotted across the room this lady, who was a dear friend of his, but he hadn't seen her for quite a while. And so he kind of made his way rather rapidly over there and told her, boy, he was really, you know, really happy to see her again, and she looked great, and it was 5 years since he had seen her. And she says, yes, and I've grown only 1 year older. And so that's how it goes, you know. So we try to avoid it. Now, we haven't succeeded either in avoiding it, reversing it, or really understanding it very well. There are many theories about aging. And whenever there's a lot of theories about something, chances are they haven't figured it out. You know, I mean, there isn't one real good one. What is aging? Well, it can be defined, as I have on occasion, a deterioration with the passage of time, or as soon as I can find how I've done it, it isn't very erudite, but it's a general process that's characterized by a decrease in vitality, an increase in vulnerability. And you can all recognize it in people probably such as myself or those who are older. There's the bones sort of get more brittle, the muscles become weaker, the joints stiffer, you have slowed reflexes, you do not recover as well from injury, there's a failing sight and hearing oftentimes, and then the memory becomes fuzzy. But I always tell people there's a compensation for all this deterioration, and that's an increase in wisdom. It seems like, you know, nobody loses, you know. I mean, everybody loses and nobody wins on this thing. But there are some compensations. Now, what are some of the theories of aging? We can say, I think, initially, that there's probably no one system sort of that fails, you know. It isn't always the heart, or it isn't always the kidneys, or something like that. Now, in the old days, they thought it was the toxins accumulate, you know, and they knew there were a lot of bacteria in the gastrointestinal tract, and if one could change this and reduce the number of toxins we were exposed to, both in the environment and the toxins produced within the body, we would grow older. I mean, we could prolong life. And for a while, you know, it was a real craze for Bulgarian buttermilk. You know, you'd change the flora of the GI tract because, you know, you go into Bulgaria or southern Russia and you see all these old people, you know. And so we all drank cultured buttermilk for a while. The chief still drinks it. And but she drinks it because she likes it. I don't know if she knows about this. The chief is my wife. And then they were investigating this, you know, and they went down there and studied these people. And I think the net result was that, you know, the people, you know, they just looked old. They weren't old, you know. I mean, so that's what happens, you know, in a lot of these. As one gets these various secrets, you know, to a long life. So that, although we know that probably these toxins do have an effect, perhaps there are some other things. And some have extended this theory to say, well, there are also an accumulation within the body of these things. And one of my friends has proposed that there is an effect on that, what he called the histohematic barrier. In other words, the barrier, he says, there's an increase in the obstruction to diffusion of the nutrients from the blood to the cell, to the cells of that are vital to our function. And one can, I guess, to an extent, show that this does happen, that there is a change in the membrane of some cells, that there is an increase in connective tissue in the intercellular space, so that one can say, well, things will start happening a bit slower. One can also show that there is some decrease in the cellularity of some tissues and a replacement by tissues that are not so good, like fibrous tissue. There is a decrease in the number of cells of the central nervous system, but there's we have a few spares up there, at least in some places, and most of us don't use a great number of them in a way. But there are a few that we can't get along without. Other people say there's an exhaustion of a fixed reserve. This has been extended to say that, well, if you calculate how many calories per gram of tissue that is expended in a lifetime, it's sort of generally uniform among the various animals. Man, I think, is about twice. But they have gone on to say, well, it's sort of like an automobile, you know, that after so long the thing just wears out. Or that we have just a fixed amount of certain materials that are critical. And it sort of goes down the tubes. And perhaps this is as good a place as any to tell about some work in which they have tried to extend life to sort of look at this. Because this might conflict with this theory. There was a fellow named McKay at Cornell. He's recently died. And what he did was to take some rats, and he kept some of them on a very low caloric intake. That he starved them. He kept them from maturing. And he did this for up to 900 days. He found out if he prolonged it beyond 900 days, that some very deleterious things would happen. Their eyesight would be affected and so forth. But he really kept them sort of juveniles then for 900 days. And then he put them on a full feeding regimen. And then they sort of lived out from that time their normal lifespan. The net result was that he about doubled the lifespan. And this, of course, was very interesting to a lot of people when this occurred. And they said, well, what's this got to do with, you know, sort of a fixed reserve? Well, the modification of this theory was that, well, this only applies once you reach adulthood. Then this applies. There are others who have done this too, and perhaps this is as good a place as any to say that the caloric intake, of course, will make a great deal of difference to you. There have been a lot of studies recently and a lot of suggestions made as to our diet. I think I generally agree with those who say that, well, you should eat less. I propose that we should eat less, but we should also eat more often. I eat about five or six times a day. But you can look at me and say, maybe I'm a poor example. If you look like this and you're not even 50 yet, you know. But I've had a very hard life. And the other thing about it is, there's been a lot of talk about decreasing the amount of fat one takes in, especially the so-called saturated fats. And we hear a lot about cholesterol today. Well, Keyes in Minnesota, I mean, he's been proposing this. He's made Time magazine with this. And he showed that essentially our problem here is in atherosclerosis, the hardening of the arteries, and a lot of these other problems that we have as regard to our heart, that this is due mainly to the amount of butter we eat, regular butter, and the fat on our meat, and most of our meat has quite a bit of fat in it, and this is just bad for us, and we should cut down on the intake of fats, but it also should be the so-called unsaturated fats, you know, like miso oil and safflower, stuff like that, you know. Well, a Norwegian friend of mine was kind of shook up at this because he said, look at who lives sort of the longest, you know. Well, a lot of these Scandinavians, you know. And he says, boy, who drinks more cream than they do, you know, eat all his fattig man and all that stuff, you know, all his fatty stuff. And so Keyes had selected certain populations to make his point. So this fellow, Kata Gudmundsson, he took another population, you see, various other populations. He says, if Keyes picks five populations, I'll pick another five, and show that it doesn't have anything to do with it, but it is related directly to caloric intake. You know, maybe your carbohydrate intake, your carbohydrate and sugar. Or you can also relate it probably to the number of telephone poles. Or, you can run all kinds of things like this. Or probably inversely to work. Because this is another very important thing. And I'll make these points as I think of them, rather than probably at the end. And this is very important, I think, is exercise. Not this weekend warrior stuff, you know. You come up the hold and say, boy, I'm going to get some exercise. So you race up the hold and late and back again, you know. You come out completely dogged, you know. And this is tougher as you get older. What you need is a more consistent kind of a thing, but also, I think, to stretch yourself a bit to increase your heart rate some. I think jogging, I don't know how long jogging will last, but it isn't a bad thing, I think, to sort of increase your heart rate. But you don't want to overdo it, especially as you get older. But you should exercise, and this is very important. And then watch your caloric intake. And cut down on the fats and the sugars. You know? Now, there's also And Barbara will probably say this is great, you know, that a lot of this is tied up with the genetics of the thing. And it goes back to the days of Pearl, who was there, worked early in this century, and I know one of the great animal scientists of our time, he died a few years ago, Sir John Hammond in England, and I was talking to him about aging one day, and we were discussing this particular subject, and he says, well, I'll say about it the way Pearl said to me. He said, how can one ensure a long life? And he says, pick a mother that has a long life. You know? Well, we can't do very much about that, but it does point out the fact, you know, that there is a relationship here, that if your parents lived a long time, you will. Well, you got a better chance of it, you know. It doesn't ensure it by a long way, because it depends on how you sort of take care of yourself. And then this is extended to say, well, there's also the things that happen to us are due to somatic mutations in our cells, that as we replace our cells in our body. Our GI tract, for example. Oh, what? The cells are replaced in our GI tract probably, the surface of an epithelium probably every 48 hours or so, you know? Well, you probably figured that out, you know. Boy, you know, you can have a real ring-dang-do of a tummy ache, you know. And in 48 hours, it's over with, huh? Your intestines have sort of lost one coat and got another, sort of, well. I mean, this is sort of suggestive of this. It doesn't prove it, but this actually happens. Now, all your cells don't replace, you know. Your skin, of course, does. And this varies with the animals and man. Unfortunately, the brain probably does not. So if they die, there isn't any replacement for them, or if the replacement, it is not by another nerve cell. So this, of course, is somewhat disturbing.
Say probably.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Well, it's for most of the cells, it's true.
I just thought it was, but it didn't.
Well, I can. There are probably some isolated cases where there might have been some stimulation of certain nerve cells, but that's why I leave that loophole. But generally speaking, it's true. And while we are talking about the brain, it is interesting that a friend of mine at Argonne, George Sacher, he sort of can predict lifespan of various species. If you tell him the relationship of brain size to body size and something about the metabolic rate, he'll predict what the lifespan of that animal should be. And it's pretty close, really. It's one of the best indicators.
How do you figure out the brain size?
Well, you have to take them apart.
Well, then he hasn't got any more lifespan.
Well, no, for a species, you see, for a species, yeah. No, this is only for a species, yeah. Yeah, they took care of that one. No, this is only for a species. I'll give you an instance of this. Some people at Utah were hot for the chinchilla, you know. And he says, boy, that thing lives to 25 or 30 years. And he says, now, what's the brain size? What's its metabolic rate? He says, it won't live that long. Well, they were wrong. And I know a friend of mine, he was trying to talk him into capturing one of these great big whales because he wanted to do some studies on it. And they were figuring out how to capture one and get it down there by La Jolla and do some studies on metabolic rate on it. That's a real challenge, you know. I got some crazy friends, and they think the same of me. Now, there's also this thing, and it's related somewhat to this connective tissue. Some of them say, well, there are things that happen within the body, and we know that they do, and it happens within our connective tissue. We call it cross-linking of collagen, for those of you who are chemists. There is a change in the connective tissue with time. The elastin changes, and you can tell that. I mean, I probably shouldn't reveal my secrets in this regard, but it's always a challenge to me to try to look at a person and, you know, how old is that person? And I usually don't look at a face, although there is a relationship, I think, with sort of longevity, with how many, you know, wrinkles there are right here. But I always look at the neck and also the hands, because this often tells you, although it varies, whether you've been out in the sun a lot or not. And probably this is as good a point as any, because I sometimes discuss this in a cancer thing, but people speak of a healthy tan today, you know. That's not true. That's known as an unhealthy tan. Because the sun, ultraviolet, does age your skin remarkably. Remarkably. And you're better off without getting all of that. And for varying reasons, not only ages your skin, but it increases the possibility of cancer of the skin. I mean, we know that the cancer of the southern hemisphere is much higher than that in the northern. I can go into a lot of explanation of this, but that isn't probably significant to this case, except to say that that there is a change in structure with time, and it's hastened by this. And a friend of mine at Davis, in fact, he's interested in sort of a conjoint study. And he says that, and he feels really strongly on this, that there are certain oxidizing things in the diets we take. And he relates some of this to the fats, the saturated fats, and other agents that what he calls are free radicals. Now, my interest in this, of course, is that in radiation, and for a time, they said, well, radiation ages one. It shortens their lifespan. And they thought, well, this is a great tool for studying aging because you can shorten their lifespan, and maybe the things that are happening with radiation are really happening like normal in normal aging. Well, this isn't quite true, but this is one of the considerations, and I might plot some of this here in a minute to explain some of this to you. But there are, with radiation, there are what we call free radicals, which are toxic materials that are formed within the body. But these also happen, I mean, we take in these materials in our food, and it does happen in regular metabolism without radiation. But he feels that one can probably extend lifespan or effectiveness during life by including antioxidants in the diet. What are some antioxidants? Vitamin E, vitamin C, And, well, there are other unnatural ones. And, or selenium, in very low levels. I mean, selenium has always been regarded, you know, as a toxic material. We know there are seleniferous plants, in especially in the West, where, I mean, cattle, for example, eat these, and they develop a lot of symptoms of that are of toxicity. But we all, but then, and then I think they fed some to some rats and produced cancer with them. But we've been embarrassed recently, or especially those that make the rules, that, to find out that selenium is in fact a required element. You know, and of course, if you have anything that causes cancer, proven cancer, even a rat, that's a no-no. You know, I mean, the Food and Drug says no. We're faced then with, we have a necessary element, but you can't take it. You know, you can't administer it because it causes cancer. Well, this is true with a lot of agents. And we have to get down to quantity. Hmm? And almost anything you take, if you take too much of it, you'll die, huh? Whether it's water or anything else. But selenium is an antioxidant. In fact, I have a friend of mine at Oregon State. I mean, he takes a little selenium every day. He's one of the big selenium operators, so he's the first one really to show that he could use a natural diet in Oregon and produce a deficiency manifested on a natural diet of selenium. That in a way it was relieved by giving selenium. It's called white muscle disease in lambs. It's a muscular disease. And all you got to do is put a little selenium in it or high amounts of vitamin E, and there is a relationship here. So this is kind of an interesting thing, and I guess what I'm saying is that with time, you know, maybe we'll find some things that may help along with this. What I'd like to do is because we have these animals that are aging, to have another group, you see, that we could probably add some antioxidants to and, you know, see what really happens. Now, let me tell you a little bit about, you know, the sort of things that affect aging and sort of how we plot some of this stuff. And the difference among various populations and among various inputs. I know a friend of mine named George Sacher, I've already mentioned him. He was really excited during the war when he was doing some radiation studies on rats and or mice or small animals. And he discovered a way of plotting this that would sort of end up in a straight line over a great deal of the lifespan. Although biologists have a real appreciation for curves, they'd rather plot their data in straight lines. It's easier to handle. And so if you can have a straight line over a good deal portion, you know, of the curve, it's easier to compare, you see? And he was proud of this because he said if one plots the age-specific mortality, in other words, here's the age of the animal, and I won't put any figures down here because it depends on what animal you're studying, or man. And if one says, well, this is one death per 1,000, and this is one death per 100, and this is one death for every 10 people, or every 10 mice or something, that over a great life, a great part of the curve, it would be a straight line. And he was real proud of this. And then he realized that Gompertz discovered this in 1815. And he was very disappointed. But so we call it a Gompertzian plot. And now that sounds highfalutin. I'll tell you what it does tell you is that as one grows older, his chances of dying are better. This is how you have to, you know, this is how you, you know, get the best of the scientists. They're always trying to, you know, throw up a big cloud, you know. Well, I'm not erudite enough to confuse you. So we do this. And another friend of mine named Hardin Jones, he's done quite a bit of study on people and various populations. And he's used the Gompertzian plot for this. And he finds some very interesting things. He finds out that among the civilized nations, that sort of this sort of is the curve, you know, or there's a their chances of dying at birth and for while the child is young, is higher than it is in a later time. And as much as a Norwegian hates to admit it, the Swedes are probably the best off here. At least they have been up till fairly recently. And the curve, this isn't too far off probably on the curve. When you're out here, you know, in the teens and all, that's a great time because if something happens to you, you can really bounce back, you know. And also the mortality is much, much lower here. But with the passage of time, it kind of catches up with you. Now, these are the Swedes, huh? And some of the Scandinavians. The Finnish male and the will lead a very Spartan life, incidentally. And also the Spanish have some of the lowest. I mean, their curve is up here. I mean, they're some of the worst in Europe. Among the less developed nations, such as India, boy, this thing looks more like this, you know. I mean, it just doesn't get down here. Your chances of dying are pretty good all the time, you know, although it gets worse out here. But you see this great disparity, you see? Now, what about inputs on this? I mean, how can you modify this thing? Well, most of the things that we find and know about, of course, move the curve upward. We haven't found very many things that will, you know, take it down this way. And so Hardin Jones, he's done a lot of things with this. He's looked at, for example, the problem of overweight. And if you're 10 or 20% overweight, you know, well, you're on a new curve. You're up here. Hmm? So that you get up here, you know, and this is sort of all she wrote, you know, you get there about 10 or 12 years sooner. If you smoke 2 packs a day, you're on this same line too. You're about 12 years. You get here 12 years sooner. If you only smoke 1 pack a day, you're on this line. You get there only 6 years sooner. If you're a bachelor, you're also disadvantaged. When he announced this, though, I told him, you better be careful with that because my observations have been that it depends on who you marry. And I think it does, but generally speaking, a bachelor does not live as long as a married person. And if you're in a rural area, you're in an urban area, you're on a different line. Hmm? And so if you add all this up, and if you're a woman, oh, and if you have children, of course I don't know if it's true today, but it used to be true a few years ago. If you have children, you're on a different line. If you don't have any children, you're up higher here. You know, your chances of dying are greater.
Does that mean if you bear them yourself, or you just?
I don't know if they made that differentiation. But I think this tender, loving care, I think, makes a lot of difference. I mean, you see, this some of the mistakes they make, for example, they found out, I know in working with rats, for example, and rats are not a good animal for a lot of things that they're being used for. I'm sort of an anti-rat man myself. They'd have the rats that they were experimenting over here, and then the controls over here. You always have controls to see, you know, to have them compare, have something to compare with. But if you're testing these animals, you always want to go in there and see if something's happening, you know. So they'd go in there and, you know, fondle them a bit, you know. And in some instances, testing certain agents, they'd find out that the rats that were fondled, even though they might have some agent that might affect them, that was sort of countermanding it. In fact, some of these were fondled, were living longer than those weren't fondled. You know? And this is true, I think, certainly in people. Those that are fondled probably live a lot longer. And there's another very interesting experiment in this line.
And I often discuss it when I talk about experimental subjects, choosing the experimental subject. And it's a recent find that it has been shown that if one fondles the rat while it's carrying the young, those young will be more gentle. And this will carry on through many generations. Now, this is a startling finding. My mother knew it. I'd hear her tell, you know, young pregnant people, you know, what she shouldn't do, you know, while she was carrying her baby, because it would affect the baby. Now, those of us who heard her, who were educated, knew better, you know. But I guess we really didn't. And I don't know this. The data on these that looks at least reasonable. Michael Fox. Is Mrs. Hobble here? Mrs. Hobble works for Michael Fox. I haven't talked to her about this. I just found out she works for him, but I know he told us about this. He's one of the better animal behaviorists. He's Washington University of St. Louis. And he told me about this, and I discussed it with him. And one can sort of make a case for this, because, I mean, if you're carrying a child and, you know, you're getting a lot of harassment, you know, I mean, your hormonal discharges are going to be a lot different. I mean, you're going to have a lot more adrenal cortical hormone and a bunch of other things that of course, are in the blood and are going to affect that fetus, aren't they? Where if you're sort of gentled and, you know, and listening to fine music and so forth, it will be different. So maybe you can make a case for this. We know, of course, that certain input, as far as sound goes, late in gestation, at least in some of the lower animals, you can affect then the learning or the recognition of that by that offspring after it's born. I mean, in other words, the fetus is hearing things. Huh? It's responding. How did I get on this? Well, all right. If one then looks at this, oh yeah, fondling, you know, tender loving care. That's a great thing. But if one then compares here, you know, an overweight bachelor living in Brooklyn, smoking two packs a day, in comparison with a woman living in rural Sweden, who has children, is also married, and she would have a lifespan of 35 years longer. Something like that, you know, according to Hardin Jones. And it probably isn't too far off. Of course, it depends a lot on the genetics of this person, who its mother, who his or her mother was. Perhaps that's all I want to say about that. If there are any questions as we go on, I'll be happy to do it. We plot the data, of course, differently. And we can plot it differently, you know, and express it in a different form. And many times we do. We have, of course, a great range of lifespans within test animals. I mean, mouse, I've often talked on mice. You can prove anything with a mouse. You know, if you want a mouse that only lives a few hundred days, we can probably get you one of those. If you want one, and I had about, I think, the longest live mouse that's been reported. The longest one lived, I think, 1,345 days. And that's an old mouse, let me tell you. And so you have all, and it depends, of course, on how you care for them, and what temperature you take care of them, and you can really modify this a great deal. I think that's enough of that. Now, how about the handling of the older person? Let's get on that. I'm no real authority on this, except my own personal experience, and I've visited
people in hospitals and nursing homes before my parents got there, and a lot of people, of course, shy away from it. And I was very interested to receive recently from my son in this regard something he had written up. He's in medical school. And it does bring out, a very interesting thing. I don't mean my son, our son. The subject of old age has never been a popular one with the medical profession. Are there any physicians here? Well, the problems of therapy and diagnosis tend to be neglected to the detriment of the individual and more still to the community. The bulk of the medical profession practicing today has received no teaching at the undergraduate level on aging or the diseases of old age, nor are there any postgraduate courses available in organized gerontology, which is study of aging or geriatrics, for medical instructors. It is quite natural, therefore, that they should tend to regard the care of the elderly as of little importance in the strict medical sense. This attitude must be changed if it is not to be said that killing people painlessly at the age of 70 is, after all, a real kindness. The segment of our population over 65 is expanding faster than the population as a whole. During the first half of this century, the percentage of total population in this group doubled and will double again in the next 40 years. Science has enabled more people to live longer, but has been delinquent in caring for them when they reached old age. While life expectancy has increased drastically in the last 100 years, the life expectancy at age 65 has only increased 6 months for men and 2.3 years for women during this same period. The health care for the aged must be improved both quantitatively and qualitatively. And then he goes on to point out that, some university hospitals do not even take an elderly person in a psychiatric ward. And he's working in a psychiatric ward at the University Hospital this summer. But then he goes on with a suggestion, which I think is a very good one. One way of meeting the demand, you see, to take care of these people is to recruit older physicians to shift their professional emphasis to geriatrics. Physicians' aging influence his attitudes towards patient illness and treatment is reflected in his practice. And he then goes on to suggest that what we ought to do is to try to really, really convince these older people, these older physicians, who usually, they can probably get along with less money, and then send them to some, postgraduate school in the care of the aged, and to encourage them in this endeavor.